Welcome to episode 118 of The Hard Truth About B2B E-Commerce. I'm your co-host, Isaiah Bollinger, and I'm back with Tim. I think, did we miss a week or two? I can't remember.
I think we missed at least 1 week because we're so busy and so popular, right? We've got a lot of things outside of the podcast. Yeah. So let me just throw a couple things out here. I do have some shout outs. I've heard from some of our happy listeners, and I want to make sure to thank them by mentioning their names. So Robin Lebo, an old colleague of mine, reached out. She listens to the podcast. Steve August listens, and he has been listening all along. And I did not know that, even though I had said hi to him a few times in between. I didn't know he was listening to the podcast. So thank you, Steve. And also Jared Kliegerman, who I've mentioned a number of times. He's just very dedicated. He works mostly in the CPG food space, but B2B and B2C. Really great guy. Really great to hear from our listeners. Please reach out. I'm happy to mention you and thank you for that. And now I'm just going to pause a moment for our sponsor mention to be inserted by our team afterwards. And then I'm going to throw it back to Isaiah to introduce our guest. Balance is a B2B e-commerce payment solution that works well for you and for your buyers. It offers a seamless one-click checkout for almost any payment method, including ACH, wire, checks, cards, even terms. It's used by leaders in B2B e-commerce, and it's as easy as buying a shirt from Amazon. Check them out at getbalance.com. Book a session and tell them what your needs are. They are the first dedicated payment platform for B2B e-commerce, 100% tailored to your needs. Thanks again to our sponsor, Balance.
Isaiah? Yeah. I'm very excited to introduce our guest, Alex Back, the CEO and co-founder, or founder. Are you founder or co-founder of Couch.com?
This one I'm going alone.
So founder of Couch.com, and then also your previous business was, digital commerce and retail in the couch and home goods space. So it sounds like you've been in kind of furniture, e-commerce for, is it been your entire career? Or is there a background even before that?
Well, before I got into furniture, I was singing on cruise ships as an actor. And so that wasn't my entire career.
You have a good voice. I was going to ask you
how long
that voice. I like the voice.
Thank you. That's really good. Nice of you.
That's good.
I started acting when I was like in high school, and wow. I grew up in New York City, so I had a lot of access. Mm-hmm. And I worked professionally for, probably about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And got into business and e-commerce along the way, and then have been deeply immersed in the furniture space, as you suggested, for the past 15 years or so.
But why that? I really want to understand that pivot. It's probably pretty rare that someone makes, it's a very different pivot. What made you go from the acting, performance?
It's sort of like a well-known anecdote that actors will generally like wait tables, and that's just sort of the one thing I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And I was a smart kid growing up. Like I had a good education. I was like, I wanted to sort of do something where I could still support my lifestyle as an actor, but use my brain a little bit. So I'd sought out all types of different jobs and sales jobs and things like that. And I got a job working for a furniture company that was doing these like activations, selling at roadshow events within Costco's. Mm. So we had this great deal, and that's how I met my former business partner, Matt Herman. He was sort of like running that, and it sort of went from there, and I stuck with it because ultimately, there just was a lot of opportunity. It just kept sort of presenting itself in different ways.
So was that original B2B? You were doing B2B sales, essentially, in that? Or were you guys?
No, that was technically, yes, we did sell it to Costco, and Costco would sell it to, they would, take a little margin and sell it to their end consumers. But this is like, if you go to Costco, the guys are like doing the Vitamix or giving you samples of hummus. It was basically that, but couches. Yep. And so we would write up orders for customers and send them to the register to complete their purchase, and we would deliver it to them.
Wow.
Later on. So it was an awesome program that we used in my subsequent business as well, that helped us really grow in the beginning.
Do they still do that? Does Costco still do that?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. They do. There are a bunch of big brands that have it sort of cornered. Like Lovesac is like going insane in Costco. They've been doing amazingly well for a long time. And then regionally, there are like players like us or my former company, Apartment 2B. We don't do it anymore. They don't. That sort of like do a similar thing. But it's a great program as long as the product's good. Because with Costco, you got to be really careful. They're tough.
Yeah.
Costco is very tough, even tougher now. I'm working with them right now in a different category, CPG, and we're trying to get some products in for a client. And they, you know, everything is tougher. So the 20% rule, I don't know if that was in place for furniture, where you can no longer have more than 20% of your business going through Costco. So it really makes it super tough for a lot of brands that explode there. And then they don't have anything to back it.
They want scale. They want to know that you're a legit business that's not too reliant on them.
It's getting really, really tough again. You know, I guess this goes in cycles in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that existed 13 years ago when I sort of flubbed numbers to make sure that we stayed with Costco, even though about 60% of our business when we started it was
there. You go.
Through Costco Roadshow. So it's funny that you mentioned that. I forgot about that.
Yeah. It's
guilty.
Costco, please do not get anyone in trouble.
Don't come back for me.
We should get Costco on here. That's what we can do next. So if anyone's listening from Costco, we'd love to get you on. Let's do that. Anyway, so tell us about the basically going from what you were doing in furniture to couch.com.
Sure. So the origin story of my former company, Apartment 2B, is pretty interesting. My business partner, Matt, he was like my best buddy. He's kind of like my brother. He was worked in the furniture space, and I was working with him, sort of assisting him. He was a sales rep for a few different manufacturers. He worked for Ashley for a while. But at this particular time, he was representing a manufacturer out of Mississippi, old school, like recliners in the couch, just old school Mississippi manufacturer, old school mindset. He had a California territory. So he was selling, you know, brick and mortar retailers, you know, containers of goods, containers of furniture at scale, and was doing really well. And then he got an email one morning from someone who wanted to open an online account. Well, this was something that they had never heard of before at this Mississippi manufacturer. So he called his sales manager. He's like, hey, I mean, I don't know if there's a territory for this, but can I open them up? He's like, well, we don't have anything, so you might as well try. Mm-hmm. So the person asked him for stuff. What do you need? Is there an opening order? No, we don't carry any inventory. Okay, so what do you need? Well, we need pictures and we need data. All right, here you go. And two emails later, it was done. A few days later, he wakes up to his first order. What? It's one couch going to one place. 3 days later, another order, another order, another order, another order. This company was CSN at the time, which ended up becoming Wayfair.
There you go.
So this was sort of our early entry point into the fact that there was a lot of opportunity in the online space that was very much untapped. And that's how it all started. We just literally wanted to create a furniture store online to see if we could do it. We had sort of a few interesting concepts at that time, which I won't get into, but ultimately we were a pretty traditional retail model and grew and pivoted a lot along the way. We had a small seed round raise with friends and family, but very, very minor, and basically bootstrapped the company to being very successful to a point of acquisition in 2018. Then I stayed on as COO for 4 years with this larger entity, which was a retail furniture chain. So I learned a lot about the inner workings of their systems and their infrastructure. Their supply chain was completely different, very reliant upon international and imports. So it was really, really a great education for me to understand both sides of the business. So I left the company a year ago. And I was, you know, thinking what I wanted to do. It pretty much was one thing in my mind was that I didn't want to work in furniture. But somebody told me that the domain couch.com was available and it had never been anything. And I was like, okay. So I went to the website that this brokerage was offering it on. And I saw the price tag. I was like, yeah, that's not happening. But then I thought about it a little bit more and thought about different possibilities. Like, could this be an amazing direct-to-consumer play? Or maybe this is something that has more scale to it. And I had this like aha moment at one point where I realized that this could be essentially a marketing platform for the furniture industry, that there was a major B2B play in this realm where we would serve the underserved or underrepresented retailers of the furniture industry, but whether it's a mom and pop furniture store down the street that you're like, how are they still in business? Or a regional chain, and we all have them in the areas that we live in this country, or some of the national brands like West Elm and Crate and Barrel. Like, there's very little online representation for these brands, very little education about them for customers. They don't really know anything about furniture. None of us really do. So the idea is create a
platform. All I know is it's gotten kind of worse, I think, in that the quality has, from my experience, it's like, it feels like the cheap stuff breaks.
Well, it's interesting because I think in older generations, like the lifetime quality was a cornerstone to most manufacturing strategies and their advertised, like their sort of value proposition. But now it's sort of the opposite. It's like fast fashion. It's like the H&M of furniture has happened. Yeah. It's like, let me get this thing that's good enough for 5 years because I'm going to want to change it anyway, versus the Thomasville table is going to last a lifetime.
Well, let me throw a couple things out there, because before we start recording, I mentioned I have some experience working in the space. So I was managing a Pottery Barn, back in the 90s, when it was basically still a catalog retail and, the customer service team that was all onshore and all that stuff. And, the people who made our furniture included folks like Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, very well-known furniture makers, but they were making, stuff private label for Pottery Barn. And they really had never sold stuff, anything except to the trade, as they say, like through designers and into all of these other situations. And now all of a sudden they were put into the situation where it's like, well, we may need 800 of the sofas, available, right? Or 9,000 available, or whatever the numbers were, because they were astoundingly big after a while. And it was fascinating just seeing how that would all work kind of in the early years of it. It really interesting. And then later I worked as a consultant for their client for Crate and Barrel. And so Crate and Barrel, like 5 years after I was working at Pottery Barn, much more advanced, really throwing a lot of talent at e-commerce, trying to figure things out, doing B2B and B2C. They were selling directly to hotel chains, directly to restaurants, all of this stuff separately from what the consumer saw. So really interesting how those early years, where people were really trying to figure it out. Now, it's a very different kind of landscape, I think, for those people and for others.
Well, what's interesting is, like, thematically, they're the same sort of thing still exists in my experience, at least. Like, you constantly find people in the furniture space having to be very dynamic and like doing things that are uncomfortable to them. There are some manufacturers like, no, this is the way we do things. These are our retailers, and that's that. But then one e-commerce relationship, kind of like you mentioned, when you talked about Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, like one e-commerce relationship, the one Wayfair connection could like explode a business, take out all their inventory. Like, these things happen very, very frequently. And it's difficult because the furniture industry is very old school, and there are very few visionary thinkers that like prepare or have contingencies in place for positive things to happen, like more business all of a sudden. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because that still exists today, I think.
Well, I'll just mention one last thing and then throw it back to Isaiah. At the time I was at Pottery Barn, the guy who was in charge was Gary Friedman, who ended up going on to Restoration Hardware.
Right.
And his whole spin at Restoration is they manufacture everything themselves, and it's like all them, you know, they don't buy from other people. They manufacture all of it.
That's very,
very expensive, very expensive, but that was their deal. And they have both B2B, B2C, you know, they do a lot of B2B sales.
Well, I want to add to that. I think that what makes furniture one of the most hard, complicated e-commerce businesses is that one, it's hard to ship affordably. It maybe requires assembly or move in, move out, right? Like a lot of people might need require that you like take out their old couch. So there's like almost like a service element to the delivery. But I also think that like most of these companies probably need a hybrid B2B, B2C approach. And from a commerce perspective, it means that you have to have both the capabilities for B2B commerce and B2C and these like complicated logistics capabilities. And actually Wayfair does some of this, but even Wayfair struggles to be profitable, and they're massive with massive technology teams. So you see these like little companies with no technology teams or like one guy. How do they pull this off? So I imagine you've seen some of this struggle, right? Or does that resonate with you at all, or just?
Yeah. Oh, 100%, 100%. It's, well, first of all, to address the just furniture being a difficult sort of different sort of product to sell online. I mean, yeah, running a national furniture distribution network, whether you're B2B or B2C, it's very difficult, and it's really hard to do well and in a cost-effective manner. And everybody's sort of like, I think there's just a lot of different dynamic opportunities, as I sort of previously said, in the furniture space that come up that make you want to spread your wings a little bit more than maybe we all should. For instance, if that hotel calls like, hey, I need 49 sofas by next week, you're like, drop everything. We need to figure this out, guys. But that's maybe not what your business should be doing. All that to say, there's so many variables to manage in the furniture space between the customer service. I mean, the logistics is very, very difficult in furniture delivery. Mm-hmm. Keeping customers happy in a business that's very hard to keep them happy in is difficult. So kind of maintaining focus, I think, is important for businesses in the furniture space, as much as there's opportunity sort of like knocking at your door constantly.
So what do you say about, you know, physical showrooms, you know, for B2B sales, you know, versus like retail places that are B2B and perhaps B2C both, right? I mean, how do you feel about that? Because again, in the Crate and Barrel example, the you know, they spent a lot of money and time figuring out like the augmented reality, you know, solutions that they now have. So you can envision any sofa in whatever setting and your home or hotel, and then order maybe without ever actually touching it. I mean, what do you think about those sort of layers in the furniture market right now, about physical touch versus not?
So here's a compelling statistic. 80% of the commerce in the furniture industry is done on the brick and mortar level.
Mm-hmm.
Yet over 80%.
That's what I thought.
Of those, yeah. Sure. It's but and I don't know that there are too many other industries, especially ones that have such a strong e-commerce presence like the furniture space does now, that boast the same metrics. Also, I will say on the B2B side, you know, almost all of the buying and planning for retailers is done at 4 markets in person in Las Vegas and in High Point, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. During the year. So there's really something to be said for every part of the business that like, yeah, this is something people need to, I mean, a buyer, if you're not touching the product and feeling it and attesting to the quality, at least to some degree, then I don't know if you're really doing your job amazingly well. So I think buyers go to markets, they buy in person, and customers generally like need to feel comfortable, pun intended, before they buy a couch. Like they want to see it in person. And that's part of our concept here. We want to bring brick and mortar back into the online space because we're just want calling a spade a spade.
Do you think it's going to become potentially some sort of like buy online, pick up in store, or try online, go to the store? Or how do you see like the digital playing into the store exactly?
Well, I've, you know, I've run a D2C brand for the last 13 years in the furniture space and watched a lot of competition come up around us. And I have my finger on the pulse, especially now I'm like back in deeply immersed with these brands and talking to them. Yeah. And a lot of them have opted to go for this sort of hybrid approach and this in-person experience. Now, even if they don't have one in every city or down the street from every customer, I think the presence of a sort of brick and mortar showroom or location gives people peace or sort of establishes some authority. There's a brand that I've been talking to for the last year and I've become good buddies with them. And they keep opening showrooms. I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, you don't understand the conversion percentage. It's over 75%. They have maybe 10 to 12 showroom appointments per day, but they're selling a $3,500 product at retail to 10 of those people every single day. Like, I don't know that many brick and mortar sleeves that are doing that much business per square foot. So if you think about it, it's like this omni-channel approach, there's some merit to it. And it's similar to what I had just said before. It's like calling a spade, a lot of people just need to see it in person. But do you want to take the plunge and really manage a showroom or an in-person experience? That's like a whole separate business, as I've learned in the past.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if you've worked with Jonathan Adler at any point, because he's another person I know, and you know, he has a huge business that's B2B. You know, there's the all little moments that consumers might know about the quirky products and gifting, and you know, these little things that are really remarkable. But there's a huge business behind it where it's like, you know, buy these funky like brass edge sofas for $4,000. And, you know, they take it very seriously. And those showrooms are very powerful. I was in one yesterday, actually, which is weird just by the timing of this, because I had to go to meetings in New York City and I walked by one and I went in and said hi to people. And it's remarkable. It's a great little place.
There will be like a marketplace showroom kind of concept where like everyone can bring, you know, one piece. And you can fractionally rent the showroom.
Why not, in a way, right? I mean, because, you know, what about all the space in malls that they're trying to
exactly
like other things? Like, maybe try that out. Somebody could do it.
Space that's dying, you know.
So, first of all, you guys just stole my idea. But second of all,
we'll be.
I don't have time to help you with that.
I'll be a co-founder.
Maybe as an agency at Trellis, but not a. I'm not looking to operate as a business. So,
having a couch comparison experience is one of sort of my early activation ideas that I really want to try. There's no shortage of cheap retail space. That's not going to be a problem.
Not a problem.
And there's no shortage of brands that want to feature their product. What's their buy-in? Like, maybe they send a few products and, you know, a small sort of marketing co-spend or whatever, co-op fee. And I've been a part of those things before too. It depends how it's presented. I think I've seen a lot of these, there are a lot of them now. These sort of in-person experiences for e-commerce brands, like companies that have like, they bought like a nice house or rented, you know, an awesome retail space in the middle of San Francisco. I was part of one.
Sure.
And it's like 18 brands there. But I think they're not very sales focused because there's not a very specific focus. My idea is to like really just have it be one thing. It's about couches. You come there, you compare the different couches against one another. And I'm hoping that would work a little bit better, because especially for some of these brands that have never had an in-person experience, like I think a lot of their customers, let's say in LA, would love to go and just, you know, see what the product is like in real life.
And, you know, one other thing, and again, this is just insider stuff. You know, I was a retail manager for years before I did e-commerce, and I managed furniture for Macy's at one point too.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I was in charge of furniture, rugs, and bedding. So that was a long, long, long time ago, like in mid-90s, let's say. But the funny thing that we always said about that area is that, you know, it's not sexy, but also you have no shrink. There's nobody's shoplifting out sofas and mattresses, right? Like, it just does not happen. It's not like what I did by jewelry, you know?
Yeah.
That's funny. We would leave our warehouse door open all day.
Exactly.
It was like, totally, what are they going to do? What are they going to do?
There, go like try. Go try. Yeah.
And then they have to pay to store it somewhere else because there's no,
like, good luck to you. You want to sell it yourself? It ain't easy. Trust me.
Yeah. That's so funny.
That's funny.
So I would imagine, though, like the digital sales and marketing, though, is still critical to getting traction and getting customers to these locations, though. Correct? Or, you know, from that
Are we talking about like a showroom experience?
Just in general, like whether it's showroom experience or your own retail location, you know, how much, and it's always hard to track perfectly, but I would imagine that most people are kind of have heard of the brand or seen it online before they come in person. Yeah.
I think, yeah, but the vast, vast majority, I think that's, you know, 90%+ is my personal feeling about that. People who will discover things online first. I mean, I'm banking my, you know, life savings on it. So hopefully that's the case. But no, I think marketing for furniture in the furniture industry is, it's always been sort of like the last thing that people consider, sadly. Some of the new D2C e-commerce players like are considering it maybe too much. And then they don't focus enough on the customer service, the product, or the fulfillment.
You need a balance, right? You need that correct. Who do you think? Who do you think is doing that well? Where it's like, you go, you know.
go ahead.
You feel like your website's good, their social media is good, but you go to the store, it's good. Like, who? If you were to kind of pick a couple winners in that space,
the world is listening. The world is listening.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, it's interesting because we were talking about, you know, the Williams-Sonoma brands and Crate and Barrel. I mean, I honestly, like, they really have set the standard, at least in my general, I'm 40 years old. So like my general age demographic of like 30 to 50, the main furniture buying audience, will often, like, they've done a fantastic job of letting the world know that Pottery Barn, Crate and Barrel, and West Elm are the places you should shop for furniture if you want something that's going to be cool and of good quality and value. And you can go to stores and see them in person. They're all
over. I mean, so my wife is like a big West Elm. Like, a lot of our stuff is West Elm.
I like their stuff too.
We went to the stores, but then also once we know what we like, we bought a lot online. So it's like, it was both. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
I'll tell you funny bit of trivia because I'm old and I have lots of these trivia stories. You know, Pottery Barn used to be owned by Gap. I don't know if people know that in general.
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s, Gap wanted to go into furniture and all that kind of stuff and then didn't know what to do with it. And so they sold it.
It's hard. It's really hard.
And then, and then Gap said, you know, sorry. And then Chuck Williams, he was much younger. He's long dead now. But Chuck Williams, who founded Williams-Sonoma, said, you know, we should probably look into going into furniture. It's to not just be kitchen people. And so they had Williams-Sonoma, and then they said, let's buy Pottery Barn, and then they've expanded from there.
They buy West Elm, or what's the story?
West Elm they bought was an independent company in Brooklyn, I believe. I remember they were an independent company relatively recently, and then they absorbed them into Pottery Barn and Williams-Sonoma Inc.
I'm way less knowledgeable than you, but if I had to choose, I would have chose West Elm, but I didn't even realize that they were all...
West Elm's a great business. I have to say, I really like what they do. They're kind of fresh and different and funky, and they change it like fashion, you know, but the quality's good.
But like you said, it's becoming more fast fashion. So I feel like if you don't keep up, you become, who knows, they could become irrelevant in 5 years or 10 years and the next trendy thing takes over. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I do. I have an interesting insight or opinion, I think, which is I'm really interested, and I've really liked the brands that have focused on doing one or two things really, really well.
Sure,
because most modern consumers, like conversely, companies that try to be try to cover all different price points, all different. So, like that concept of the large furniture store that has something for everybody. It exists and it's still very, very popular, but ultimately its days are numbered. Like customers, like with modern technology, we want to look for the very specific thing that we're looking for and we want to get it right away. We don't want to browse like an endless aisle of things.
Very few places like that are going to survive. I say IKEA will, You know, IKEA will be fine because they're kind of, they straddle a strange line. Like they have everything, but they also really aim for a lot of funk and fresh, you know, and they might stick around, but there are very few people that are big, big, big players that I think are going to make it.
But I think what you're getting at, some of these guys that do one or two things really well, you might not know, or they might not have a strong digital presence. Is that kind of
part of it? Yeah, well, I think they've like cornered their niche really well. Like there's a brand that I love that I'm talking to now for couch.com to be sort of our outdoor anchor. So if you're listening, anyone from Outer, you know, I'm a big fan. But they've started with one product. They marketed it extremely well. They knew the timing of when that product was supposed to be marketed. Like they knew when to push on the gas. They knew when to take their feet off the gas. Obviously people don't buy outdoor product that much in the like Christmas time area or like leading into the winter. But right now it gets really hot. It's liveouter.com.
I'm checking it out right now. It's,
you know, yeah, they're just website. Sharp.
They got a good website. I got to give them credit for that.
I know who they
which
are.
Which I could say we built it. But,
you know, I think of Frontgate too is a company like that. They're sort of matured in a different way, but they were really focused on like, we're doing your patio and we're making it super luxurious and that's what we're going to do and that's it. And so they were kind of doing that for a long time. Now I think they've gotten bigger and done many other things, but I like that focus though. That's how I knew them, you know.
I assume it's that outdoor sofa was their flagship, or is that
yes,
it looks like they have a lot more now, but
they do, but it's all, you know, outdoor, it's all outdoor furniture. So I think they've expanded because it made sense to. But conversely, like my former company, we were always sort of overly enticed by the other categories in the furniture space. Well, we got to offer, we might as well, we have all this traffic, we might as well offer dining tables, we might as well. And it was actually really difficult to do that well. I sort of wish that we had gone back in time and just committed and went all in on couches and upholstery, which represented about 85% of our business. But like that 15% was calling our name all the time. And we're just like all these campaigns and all this time spent.
So what about sustainability and the furniture industry? How, where do you see that going? Where are we now?
I mean, I have an interesting take on this. I don't think we're anywhere close. The furniture industry is, I mean, it's, I don't know, probably the American furniture market, the 80 to 90% imported. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's going to require, I mean, it's such a global thing. It's going to require so much change and cultural shift. I mean, we've seen some of it. I mean, things have gotten better in that regard. And certainly we've been stricter in the US about what we're bringing in. California, where I live, is very strict about what you're able to sell. But generally speaking, it's like anything goes if it's imported at more or less. And
you control what these other countries are doing. And it's just, yeah.
What goes in sofa cushions most often now? What goes inside?
Polyurethane foam. It sounds really bad, but I don't think it's that. I don't think it's the polyurethane. No,
it's not that bad. I used to see horsehair. You know, people were buying horsehair still inside cushions when I started, you know, in this world.
And wow.
People are still doing that. So there are all kinds of different things.
Jeez, Tim, how old are you?
I was born in 1843. Yeah. But luxury furniture, you know, for a while used to do things like, you know, like how you have goose down, you know, comforters, duvets and all that sort of stuff. There were all of these other things that people do in luxury cushions for furniture, including stuff like horsehair and whatever. And it was really like, is that what should be in a sofa? It's like, I don't know. So these things have adapted. But then for a while, it was all these horrible chemicals that people were concerned about or, you know, whatever that was in them. Now, I'm not sure. And that's why I'm throwing it out there. I want just to have that conversation thinking, you know, it's something and it needs to be considered. I'm not sure where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the thing about furniture manufacturing is that there's sort of like two heads butting against each other. One is a sustainability and one is safety. And like people, there was, and I weathered the storm myself as a retailer of couches, like there was an HBO documentary a number of years ago about like the chemicals that were in sofas, but these are flame retardant chemicals. It's not like they're there for fun. They're there to protect people because people smoke cigarettes on their couch. They do dumb things. We live our lives on these things, and so there's safety regulations surrounding it. The same way there is flame retardant chemicals in every single mattress and also every single seat that we sit on in a car every day. So it's interesting. It's like where do we go from here? How much do we commit to sustainability? It will make everything more expensive, possibly less safe. And I'm not advocating one way or another. I'm just
I just like having the conversation.
Problem when everyone's like, oh, we got to get rid of oil, which like, yes, theoretically is great. But if everyone's heating cost goes up 100% or 200% and 30% of the people can't afford food, it's like, you know,
I just want petroleum based sofas. That's what I want. Only vinyl made out of petroleum. That's it.
How do you steal two of my ideas in one podcast recording? This is unbelievable.
Just kidding, everybody. Just kidding.
That sounds very the opposite of flame retardant is when I think that.
That's really funny in a way,
though. Yeah, it sounds like it would probably burn very quickly, maybe.
Oh, my God.
I'm not an expert on anything.
What sort of wood? I'm going to ask another question because I like knowing these things. And consumers want to know, what sort of wood is the most common use for structure in a sofa right now?
I think the most common is pine, which is technically a softwood, but it is, I have a lot of, I mean, I've shipped hundreds of thousands of pine frame sofas that all came with a lifetime guarantee on the frame and workmanship. I mean, we're talking a 0.00001%. You know, breakage. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be, in my opinion, as strong as some people make it out to be. That being said, there is a sign of greater quality. The harder the wood and the more hardwood is used within a piece, because usually hardwood frames are not all hardwood. There'll be some softwood or engineered wood, in certain areas, but, plywood, but alderwood is another sort of like accepted, you know, good hardwood that a lot of couches are made with. It's more expensive. It's heavier. So now as shipping costs are in many cases based on weight, a lot of manufacturers and retailers, you know, are keeping that in mind. But that seems like common sense, but it does affect things when you're shipping things more globally, nationally. You know, you have to consider some of the things that you didn't before when you're just doing it more on a local level.
How is the global supply chain affecting all this? I mean, obviously with COVID, there was the huge backup. Is that back to normal and it's less of a problem and now it's more of a demand issue? I think we talked a little bit about that, but.
Yeah, that is strangely what happened. I mean, I think we all thought that everyone was going to find alternatives to the Asian market for furniture import and manufacturing because of what happened in 2020 and 2021. Like businesses got crushed because of this and because they weren't able to get product, to be clear.
Yeah.
One thing that's emerged though, like the Mexican furniture market has exploded in the last few years and they make fantastic products and they're able to do it in, you know, when you factor in ocean shipping and everything, they're able to compete with sort of Chinese, Malaysian, Indian pricing models. So it's been very interesting to watch that sort of happen. Like the Guadalajara furniture market is a thing that like a lot of furniture buyers in the industry will now go to, whereas it used to be absolutely nothing.
So Pat, I'm going to ask a style question. What's the most popular style sofa, color, anything you want to just throw out there instead of curiosity?
Yeah. So I think that it's very clear. And I just went to the recent furniture market in Vegas. Broad strokes, comfort, the visualization of comfort is like the big thing. And it's been the big thing for the last few years. Like You mentioned Restoration Hardware before. They came out with this cloud sofa a number of years ago. It's the most knocked off piece of furniture since like the Eames chair back in the 60s.
I know exactly the sofa. Isn't that funny? I have it in my head right now. I know exactly.
Yeah. And so everybody and their mother tried a knockoff version of that. Mm-hmm. And some are successful, some weren't. But it's sort of like that everything has been like comfort focused, like. And I think it's maybe a result of a pandemic. Like people weren't entertaining as much. You know, I have like 19 pairs of sweatpants that I didn't have in 2019. So we all sort of like went for that, that more comfortable style and aesthetic. And you see that a lot in social media and young people, like just, you know, curling up into their couches. So we're seeing like more alternative types of cushioning, like, you know, down type cushioning, or Trillium is a really, really cool foam based product that is a very like a down alternative kind of thing. Sure. But yeah, you'll see kind of like chunkier styles. And two fabrics that are very hot right now that I never thought would be. One is like the boucle, like very, very highly textured, fuzzy fabric is very sure. in. Yep. Chunky corduroy is about to be in like everybody's
chunky corduroy. Is this 1972? What's going on?
I don't get it.
I hope that one doesn't last too long. So,
oh my god, I had corduroy pants in elementary school that were chunky corduroy. I remember that.
Oh my goodness. I mean, and it's real chunky too. It's a really wide rail.
Oh my god, that's crazy.
It's a look. I'm trying to look for a picture, but the other one that is that was very popular that I saw is monster fur.
Is this for all our furry friends? I mean, what is this, man?
Oh, don't go there. No, I think it's just this. It's like, how do we make something look even more comfortable so people buy it?
More ridiculously comfortable, like in the same, yeah.
Like insane, like literally like a Muppet's fur.
Yeah.
And this guy told me a story. I was like, oh, this is really cool. I'm like taking a picture. He's like, can I take a picture? He's like, yeah. I mean, we had this at last market, but we had, I forgot, some big furniture chain come in and the guy's like, how many have these? We'll take them all. Because it's the perfect, like, entry point from a visual merchandising perspective when people walk into the store, like, oh my god, look at this, it's a conversation piece, and people actually buy it.
Oh my god.
What's interesting to me about this furniture space is that it sounds to me like to really succeed you need some sort of like ideal mix of good digital strategy with e-commerce and marketing, but like some level of in-person showrooms or retail. And then also probably some mix of B2B. Like it's probably very hard. And I think you're seeing the companies that try and only do one of those things struggle, right? Like if they're only retail with not a good digital presence, they're struggling that way. You know, you need some of the economy of scale of B2B, but you also need that physical, like look at Wayfair, no physical presence. I think it's probably a mistake. Maybe they should have some showrooms, right? Like it seems like you kind of almost need this like omni-channel hybrid B2B, B2C kind of like flexible business model, right? Is that kind of a fair like summary? I know I'm maybe oversimplifying it, but
no, I think you're absolutely right. But I honestly think that the furniture retailers that and manufacturers that are doing well are focusing on the modern technological tools and investing in them, whether that is from in a marketing perspective or a back-end perspective. They're just like, and a lot of these things for some of these enterprise clients can be very, very expensive. We're talking, you know, $50 million ad budgets, like allocating those towards digital marketing, investing, you know, $500,000 in an amazing website experience. These are things that legacy furniture retailers and manufacturers are not willing to do.
Yeah.
But I was at the showrooms in Vegas.
We're competing against
that. You can tell which ones are hot and which ones are not.
Yeah. And it's the ones that are doing those investments, right? But it's a mix, right? Like you still need to have good product and you still maybe need to have like that West Elm kind of experience, right?
Yeah. And that's the other thing. Like I think, you know, the one thing in furniture I think people underestimate the most is the customer experience, it's very, very difficult. And we've seen, like, you look up reviews of most furniture stores and online retailers, they're atrocious. Like, yeah. People.
Delivery. Like, delivery. I mean,
delivery will kill you. Yeah. So basically, I mean, that was my one big thing at Apartment 2B. Like, we grew slow and steady for most of the time that we were in business before the pandemic, and then we sort of accelerated, but we always took care of the customer to a fault. I mean, we would give full refunds and let people keep products. Like, keeping our online reputation squeaky clean was so important to our success as a brand, to create comfort and confidence with customers and future buyers, that people don't invest in this, but I am like a staunch supporter of like full customer care, no bots, no Philippines, just make it happen. Do it the right way.
Yeah, I'm a big customer care fan too. I mean, I do like bots though, depending, like for FAQs, like, you know, for,
oh, sure.
Like that sort of stuff, I think it's perfectly suited, like to narrow, you know, what you're interested in and find. And then yeah. I love in-person customer care and furniture. I used to go visit people's homes on requests. Like, we'd set up these schedules just because, you know, I was selling furniture, and it was like, if they couldn't quite envision it, then it's like, well, all right, we're going to go talk about it, and I'll bring swatches with me, upholstery swatches and whatever. Is that still a thing? Like visuals, digital, you know, sending of an image of like a fabric and the colors or whatever versus the physical handoff or sending of the fabric swatches? Are people doing a lot of both at this point?
It's interesting. So we were big. So I mentioned before, we sold 85% upholstery at my last company, big couch retailer. Mm-hmm. So we offered free fabric samples. There was a tremendous expense surrounding this between.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we inventoried and stocked, I don't know, about 150 different fabric swatches. Mm-hmm. And labeled them and had full-time employees. Like, this was a major thing because it was our, I mean, there was data to back this up too, because about 50% of people who ordered fabric swatches ended up buying something from us.
Yeah.
There you go. It's a touch point. It's something that makes people feel connected and comfortable. Even if they can't sit on the couch, they felt the fabric and it becomes real.
It's the closest before you buy. It's the closest thing you can get to a try before you buy in the industry, you know, from an e-commerce.
Yeah.
Brand. Yeah.
Right. And then you have these companies, like I mentioned before, my friends at Seventh Avenue, with this startup, they have these showrooms where there's one sales manager I talked to. He's like, I have a 93% conversion rate. That means 10 people walk in, 9 people a day.
Unbelievable.
He's selling $3,500 sectionals.
That probably means, though, is that they've done a lot of research before they've come. They've probably seen the social proof on the website. My guess is there's a digital component to that that's leading to some of that success.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big thing. Like, I think they are really heavily invested in Meta and Instagram and like,
that's what I mean.
And like influencers
sold like, already by the time you get to the store, you know what I mean?
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. They're not, it's not like a magic. It's a closing mechanism.
Yeah.
You know,
the
romance. I'm so glad you said that, because I was going to go in another direction for a second too. There are some brands I think that have done extraordinarily well over the years because they had that look, they had a feel, a culture, a lifestyle associated with their goods. So, like, you know, they're obviously, you mentioned Eames, but all these mid-century modern, you know, pieces, and Knoll and Herman Miller and all that. But then there's also stuff like Rochebobois. You probably know who they are, right? You know, the
French. I actually don't.
They're a French furniture company.
Okay.
They have showrooms in the US. There's one in New York City that's pretty remarkable. But they're all about like sexy luxury, you know. They're
right.
It's always like models draped over the furniture. Very French. It's very, very French. But it really is an incredible like life that they built around their furniture. Because really, it's furniture. If they didn't have those models associated with it, I wouldn't be thinking of it in the same way. But they always do. It's like they just came off the runway from something, and they happen to be sitting on the sofa, right? And so it's a remarkable business, and their stuff ain't cheap. I bet they do have a 9 out of 10 you know, because people go in there and it's like,
you right, know, yeah, they know what they're
already kind of sold. Yeah. So I want to, you know, as we're kind of getting close to the end, I'm curious how you guys approached the balance between B2B and B2C. Like at what point, or were there points where you're like, hey, let's focus more on B2B and get larger orders, or we want to get the direct to consumer data and we want to get the higher margin on, like, how did you guys, or how would you approach that or advise someone? Cause I think that's just a challenge for everyone, but it sounds very difficult in furniture to kind of figure out, you know?
Yeah, it's very difficult. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we would get these opportunities. Some of them worked out. I visited like a college campus and we were going to do like all their couches. And I spent all this time, you know, getting materials together, trying to sort of, just to use a direct term, pretend that we were a B2B operation and that we had those capabilities. And I was like, can I take this to the finish line? And it didn't work out, that particular thing. So a lot, sometimes they did.
How big of an order would that have been theoretically? Just,
you know, like $100,000 order or something like that.
So pretty big. Yeah.
Pretty big.
Yeah. When your average order value is, you know, 1,000, if you have literally like 100 orders in one just by half. And I think that's really the thing. It's like, do you want to just be hyper-focused on marketing to less, people, but you know, for that have higher purchasing power, and is sort of, or do you want to, you know, diversify and go after the direct to consumer, do the direct to consumer approach? Ultimately, I don't think that a retail brand should be looking for that business.
The B2B side.
Right. And simply because, like, there's really no margin in it at the end of the day. There's not that much margin in furniture. So, you know, I think it was really tough to do the math, and it has to be just right, you know, to make it work.
You have to be more the manufacturer than have that margin from that side, you would say? Or
yeah. Here's an anecdote. Like, we did, so we did this business with Costco that I talked about before. Yeah. We started these in-person road shows next to the hummus guy or whatever else. And then it flourished into these online events that we did with Costco.com. The biggest talking to I ever got from the owner of the company that purchased ours, who I reported to, was when we did like multiple millions of dollars over the course of 2 weeks with a Costco.com event. And this is because the margin is so low, it screwed up everything else. Like, in a certain, like, if it were 30 orders, it would be great. Since it was like 400 orders, though, our production got backed up, other customers suffered, our operational. So it's like there's something about like
our mix. It has to be that, right? Yeah.
I mean, you know, you remind me of something. There was an exercise I did. I used to do like crash courses. I would teach them in digital marketing and whatever. And one of them, I had this illustration that I'd put together with some friends and showed a big picture of a person's room, like a den or a living room. And it had all these different things in it and they were labeled. And it's like, well, which is the highest margin product in this room? And it's like a guy in his tidy whities drinking beer, watching TV, you know, on an ugly sofa, whatever. And it's the tidy whities, right? So basically, the margins on the furniture were low. The margins on the electronics were low. The beer was low. And the highest was the apparel. And so I always brought that up as an example in a way. It's like he's eating Doritos. The margin's not high enough. It's like, you know, pick the highest margin thing in there. And almost no one ever got it because they were thinking there was something else like that was more expensive.
You make it important. Right. I think it sounds like inventory and production is so difficult and logistics and all of that. And so if you sell all your inventory at low margin and you have nothing left over for direct to consumer, then that's not a good, but if you do like enough where maybe you can produce more at a lower cost and still have some for direct to consumer, like it could work that way, right? Like
It depends. I mean, sometimes we were able to, let's say we had a surplus of something in our more recent years, we were buying containers of furniture when we reached a certain level of scale. We had, you know, 80 beds sitting in the warehouse and found the right buyer. We could maybe make a deal and push it. So it always, I guess it makes sense to listen to opportunities because it could work out. But yeah, if you're not set up for it, it's probably not worth your time. And I think that's something that I've learned and matured into finally, that like, you can't be all things to all people. As much as opportunities may be calling your name, you kind of have to just buckle down and focus sometimes.
So if you're going to be serious about B2B commerce, you have to be like really prepared to be able to serve that market, like that, and handle the production value and whatever it is.
Yeah. I think it's quite different. Yeah. And ultimately, like if we had to make one major distinction when it comes to furniture, I would say, don't get into B2B unless you really own the supply chain. Like the company, both companies I've talked about today, Outer and Seventh Avenue, they are directly connected. They source their own product. They have control over the factories producing their product. They can step on the gas. They can take their feet off the gas. But when you're buying from somebody else, you're probably not going to have enough control or margin to make it a successful thing without like losing all your hair. You know what I mean?
That's why people are ripping off Restoration Hardware. Like you said, they're making their own stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
So these guys that control that could build out the B2B commerce infrastructure, and you know, if Costco makes another 100 orders on the site, they could scale up to that kind of, that's what you need basically. You need that up and down.
Scale. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I should connect the Costco people with the Seventh Avenue person, because they would be a good fit, I think, in some ways. But yeah,
if they're both listening.
Hey guys.
You know,
we are. Yeah.
It should happen.
It's an interesting takeaway. It just kind of shows you how much more difficult B2B is, and from a scale perspective, that, you know, as attractive as it is to do these giant orders, if you can't actually scale to that, it could backfire.
Yeah. I mean, look, the Costco orders 1,000 couches. Like, where are you getting them from? I mean, we're like, okay, what other factories can we make this? Will they know? Will they find out if we do a little bait?
You'll have worse quality from a second factory, right? Like,
I mean, I think these are real things that people think about. So yeah, if you don't really control the supply chain, I think it could be very difficult to try to do anything B2B. And just in general, it's difficult in the furniture space. Like, you really need some big, you know, big clients that are consistent and are,
what about like light thriving B2B, business, right? Like, maybe you foray into, you know, a small job, or is that a way that maybe someone might expand and do some like tiered pricing on the website, sort of like light B2B commerce?
I would call that's very, very popular. And I would say in the form of the interior design trade, which is a big driver of furniture sales.
They're huge. They're absolutely huge. Yeah.
So much so that some of the companies that you used to work with, Tim, and Crate and Barrel and Pottery Barn, they'll incentivize these interior designers big time, because they still have more margin giving 20 or 30% off to interior designers to let them sell this product to their clients or whatever they want, than they do doing like a hotel where they're giving like 40 or 50% discount to furnish, you know, 20 rooms or whatever.
You'd almost ideally, in that case, you're not ready for Costco or whatever, but you could build an interior design portal or a B2B version for interior designers that they can
work. Absolutely. On. Yeah.
And they have some, you kind of build around that market. And that's a way to get in without having to.
It'd be in a showroom, like at a place like the Pacific Design Center, right? I mean, that's a.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
If you've ever seen
it, great LA reference.
Yeah.
Beautiful LA reference.
Yep. I've been there.
I think that's an important point. It's almost like, I think that the idea of B2B and B2C, like, it's almost like forget those terms. And it's just like levels of volume. And there's obviously levels to it. And there's different personas around the buyers. And it's almost a better way to think about it. I think sometimes the like B2B versus B2C, it's like kind of oversimplifies the nuance of all this stuff. Yeah.
That's a great point.
One other way I'd put this too, you mentioned interior designers, but just to make a slightly different point too, is that I remember at Pottery Barn having people working with architects, right? Because architects, have their specific designers that they work with for their projects, right? So you're basically going to another level, right? The buildings are getting built. They're going to go to their teams. Those teams of interior designers are going to furnish all of these places. And so you're kind of going in from that angle. And the architect says, well, I'd like you to work with, you know, this company for this project. And then the interior designers have to go back to you. You know, it's really, there's so many ways to work that. It's great.
I want to add a point to this because I think it would be relevant to a broader scope of B2B commerce people, which if you think about it, you know, the highest levels of B2B, like it's going to be hard to automate that with e-commerce for most people. But there's a lot of market, I think, in this like independent contractor space. Like if you think about, okay, in your space, it's interior designers, but if you're plumbing supplies, it's the individual contractors. And there's probably this massive market of B2B buyers, but they're really just kind of individuals or very small operations. So they probably don't need that much different from the traditional B2C, but maybe a little bit of additional functionality to kind of make it a better experience for them, you know?
Yeah, I think that's like a hybrid model. And a lot of manufacturers in the furniture space have invested a lot in enticing these sort of micro businesses, if you will, like these interior designers that'll pop, you know, a few orders a month. But that's definitely more than one order a year from a D2C customer.
You get 100 of them or 1,000 of them. Like that's big business, right? Like,
Exactly.
So we're getting close to our wrap up time. Is there something you want to make sure our listeners hear about you or your business before we close out?
Well, you know, with couch.com, we're currently building the eventual platform, which is going to have a lot of bells and whistles and technological elements. What we have up currently now at the time we're recording this is a content site that has really helpful info, a lot of videos with me and just explaining different aspects of the furniture.
You couch surfing. I like that video.
I literally put a couch in Malibu. He's in his
surfer shorts. It's jam.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I like it. Put your couch in the ocean.
You know, your actor background is perfect for some of this marketing.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness. just press play. I'm ready, baby. We're building this platform that's going to have really just a lot of utilitarian elements that are missing in the online space, like an AI-powered quiz that will really get to the root of what's most important for every customer by asking them some key questions. And with every couch buyer, there's usually a few lead variables, like I need something tomorrow, or I need something that's good with cats. My cat will literally destroy this if not. So there's certain things that are deal breakers for a lot of people. But oftentimes, if you go to a site like Wayfair or you just start searching around on Google, you have to do a lot of digging to sort of get to that point. So let's start with the deal breakers and then romance you with, you know, the beautiful pictures of lovely furniture. So that, you know, that's something that's to come at couch.com and really just for any brands out there, like we're really trying to democratize the online space by offering a reasonable entry point for like a mom and pop store, call it like a $500 a month branded page subscription where we include you in this many emails and, you know, you have presence on our website. Those kinds of things are going to be differentiators for couch.com in the online space.
So you're going to become like a SaaS media play, kind of hybrid tools and kind of advertising for these companies.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of scale in that sort of world when you think about, you know, us as the data that we're going to have and sort of this sort of couch ecosystem that we're creating and what we can do for furniture retailers out there being sort of part of the marketing arm for many of them if they don't have one. I mean, there's like an agency you know, managed service element that could emerge at some point. But in the beginning, we just want to help people find great couches and we want to help the retailers find these people without having to go to the town square and be like, "Do you need furniture? Do you need furniture?" These are people who are looking for couches, so go get them.
I like it. Good job. I'm excited. I'm going to be following this.
For sure.
Following this and see where you go. This
is everyone needs to go to couch.com and track the progress of couch.com. I mean, it's such a good domain.
I love it.
It's an awesome domain. So
I want swag, though, too. You need to have swag. Now that you own couch.com, there has to be swag with this. This is too good. You've got to.
I know. Yeah. Well, yes. We're 3D printing tiny couches as we speak.
There you go. See, I like that. There's my next key ring. That's perfect. Well, thank you so much, Alex. Alex Back from couches.com. Couch.com. I correct myself. Sorry.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.